Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thank you so much for joining me today. Today is part of National Police Week, and it is a time when the lives of those who surrendered their lives in the line of duty are honored. I'd like to read something to you that I wrote as an active duty police lieutenant one night that I attended the police memorial. This is part of the beginning of my book, True Blue, to Protect and Serve. In valor, there is hope. I stood transfixed before these words, carved in the mottled granite. Candlelight reflected from thousands of badges gleaming proudly on the chests of the uniformed men and women. As I watched, the words began to expand and undulate in time to the chorus of bagpipes, as homage was paid to the thousands of names these few words would guard through eternity. I shivered despite the warmth of the May evening, and felt an almost eerie sense of protection in the company of the souls of heroes. I looked away for a moment as the solemn sea of uniformed police officers raised their candles. There was something besides sadness to be read in these faces, be they smooth or craggy, yellow, black, white, or brown. It was the look, the steely look of resolve, visible through the tears flowing freely down their cheeks and onto their uniforms. I didn't bother to wipe away my own tears, for they bonded us together. Each of us knew that we would never betray the trust placed in us by those we serve and those we serve with. We would never yield to those who would threaten or attempt to destroy our country or our way of life through crime, violence, or terror. We as a people will prevail over those who would harm us. None of us doubt the truth of these words. In valor, there is hope. I saw it in the faces of our nation's police officers as they stood surrounding the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. And I heard it in the silent voices of those whose names lay forever carved upon its sacred stone. That's the way I began my book, True Blue, to Protect and Serve. And that memory is vivid in my mind. Police Week started under President John F. Kennedy. And up until the mid-80s, there was no monument, and it was built with donations sent in by the police and the public. And now it's been a sacred place for law enforcement officers to attend all throughout the year, but especially during Police Week. It has upon it carved the names of about 20,000 law enforcement officers, all who gave their lives in the line of duty. It's an almost magical place for law enforcement officers. And I urge that anytime that you are in Washington, that you visit this site. And very similar to the Vietnam Memorial, with those names that are carved upon it, it gives you a sense of loss, but it also gives a sense of pride. And this is something that's really, really needed these days, the pride in the men and women who serve. They are also building a tremendous museum. It's going to be actually subterranean, and it's going to have state-of-the-art everything, including the names that you can touch the name of the officer, and his biography will be displayed for you, and you'll hear it. So, in essence, if you have the opportunity, I really suggest that you go and you spend a few minutes looking at this memorial and reflecting on the sacrifice of so many of those who serve and protect. Let me give you a little bit of history about Police Week. It was originally designated National Police Week by President Kennedy. And there was no memorial, there was no monument at the time. And then in the early 80s, I believe, there was a tremendous effort by Representative Mario Biaggi from New York, who worked with a young man named Craig Floyd to make this memorial a reality. and they collected millions of dollars in donations. The United States government, of course, gave the land. They built this wall, and it's a huge granite wall, and it literally has the names of every single police officer who's been killed in the line of duty. About 20,000 names on this. And it's really a solemn place for police officers to gather. And it's attended, you know, all the time. People are constantly walking by and walking through and looking at the names of the officers. It's a place where survivors come and they take a piece of paper and a pencil and they trace the name of their loved one, their fallen, on this paper. And many people keep these little pieces of paper forever. It's a way to keep connected to the person that they lost. And watching that take place is really a very emotional thing to see. I've attended Police Week, which is May 15th through the 21st, for many, many years, especially as a representative of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, because I was the assistant commander of the Honor Guard for those years. And not only did I attend Police Week, but had the honor of standing guard during the ceremonies for that. And that's in the police world, that truly is an honor. And during this week, cops will come from all over the country. Not only all over the country, I should say, but all over the world. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the London Metropolitan Police, and a contingent of people. And what it really does is shows the unity that the police have, and it shows the solidarity that police all over the world feel for one another. During the memorial itself, during the police week, there's a number of events that are held. And that includes a candlelight vigil, which is what I was referring to when I read the short excerpt from my book. And I got to tell you, it's one of the most moving experiences that I've ever felt. You're literally within a sea of uniformed police officers. Approximately 30,000, up to 30,000, will attend these ceremonies. So it's really something to behold. And it's very, very emotional. The survivors are treated with such care and such dignity. And one thing that I really want to say, you know, President George Bush was not the most popular of presidents, but I can tell you this: there's something that he never told people, but he did every single year that he was the president, and that was he met privately with the families of every single police officer who was killed in the line of duty the previous year, whose names were going to be unveiled in that carved granite. It was an incredibly poignant gesture on his part, and it was something that he did not want to be made public because it was private time with those families. I had a deep abiding respect for that man when I saw him do that. And whether, you know, you like him or don't like him, that to me showed a tremendous amount of character. So there is something else being done now. They're about to build, in fact, they are in the process of building a tremendous museum. It's going to be somewhat subterranean, and it's going to be state of the art. It's going to have some tremendous displays of all kinds of things involving policing, as well as honoring those that have given their lives. So next time you're in Washington, stop by, take a look. And I think that you can't help yourself but to feel moved by what you will see. Well, that's my view from the blue for this week. And I think we'll take a walk over to the interview room where you will love my next guest. For today's interview room, we are going to meet Dr. Ron Martinelli. Ron's a really interesting guy. He's a retired San Jose police detective, but he has gone on from there to become recognized by the media as America's forensic expert. He's a nationally renowned forensic criminologist. And he's the only police expert in the country who's also a certified medical investigator. He's a prolific writer. He's been on CNN and Fox and One American News Network, Investigations Discovery. He's been all over the media. And what's really interesting about what he does is about 20% of all the nationally known high-profile police death cases go to Ron for investigation. And so what he does is he does officer-involved death investigations and lends his expertise to defense teams, prosecutions, etc. So today he is my guest in the interview room on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Ron, thanks so much for joining me today.
Randy, what an honor to be on your show, and it's good to talk to somebody from Las Vegas, where I spend quite a bit of my time as the Attorney General's expert.
Oh, really? I was unaware of that. So now I learned something from today's interview. You have a storied career. First of all, let's talk about your previous career. You were with the San Jose PD.
Right. I'm alumni from San Jose PD. I've done over 20 years in the business. I retired from the San Jose Police Department, and I took over one of the state of California's criminal justice training centers and police academy. So, and I've had a private practice since, I'm going to date myself a little bit, but since 1978, which makes this just about, I think, my 36th year of inside the law enforcement and forensic communities.
So while you were still serving on the San Jose PD, were you also doing this?
Oh, yes. I didn't get into the forensic side of it until 1992. My first federal case was Rodney King.
Wow, that's a way to start.
Yeah, it is. How'd you like to begin your federal career, as an expert within the federal court system by dealing with Rodney King? But while I was a detective and police officer, I had another career that the department was kind enough to allow me to participate in. Of course, I couldn't take any conflict cases or anything like that. But I had that's how I started, and I was also a university professor teaching criminology and police sciences at the time.
Wow, that's quite a background. Let's talk about what you do. What is, it's such an unusual career. So the listeners understand, talk a little bit about what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis and about your practice.
Well, sure. As I said, this practice has been around for some time. I think the thing that intrigues people the most is that I direct a team of death investigators, which are retired homicide supervisors, currently and retired working physicians, forensic scientists in all of the areas of forensics, ballistics, toxicology, crime scene reconstruction. So we have engineers, we have our own labs. Basically, we can do everything that the FBI can do except for DNA. And the only reason we don't do DNA, because we have an outstanding DNA expert here, is because the lab would cost us about another $500,000 to build it. And then we're constantly have to deal with, government oversight on making sure everything, works properly.
But sure.
I'm sort of like, for some of your older listeners, and they watched Mission Impossible, and you had Mr. Phelps, and then, you get a mission, and you figure out, he puts a bunch of dossiers on the table, and he figures out what team he's going to put together for this unique incident. That's exactly what I do. I'm Mr. Phelps. And I get very much involved in the investigations as team leader.
Let's go into, you've had to work some really, really high profile death investigations. Do you do it for the government, or do you do it as, say, if a police officer is being sued, do you work for the defense of the police officer? Does his defense attorney hire you?
Oh, boy, what a great question. And just to keep it real simple, forensic experts like myself, we do not work specifically for people or entities. We, our advocacy is for forensic facts and information. You know, attorneys advocate for people, and they advocate for agencies or governments. We don't do that. We advocate for forensic facts. So anybody can hire us. The majority of the work that I personally do, because I like it, are agency and officer defense cases. I also handle the criminal defense or the prosecution of officers as alleged during criminal offenses. I do some plaintiff work, and also the courts will bring me in from time to time when they want an independent expert to come in and discuss something for the jury. As a matter of fact, last week I spent a week in Scranton, Pennsylvania on a case where the judge qualified me to discuss tasers and electronic weapons and what the psychological and physiological effects are of people under the influence of taser. That's all about. So that was a very important thing for me to be able to do in the third district out there back east.
Interesting, really interesting. Now, you know, you said that one of your first cases was Rodney King.
Correct.
Since that didn't involve a death, why were you called in?
Well, because it's a high-profile case, and when I first started out, I just lucked out that I got that high-profile case. And by the way, you know, full disclosure, they used about, you know, both sides used about 30 experts, of which only a handful were described as disclosed experts. Actually, a disclosed expert is a person that's going to go up in front of the court and, is going to write a forensic report, going to get up before the court and actually give testimony before the trier of fact, who is a judge and or a jury. In my case, they brought me in as an expert to ask me some specific questions and get some context and background on the use of force. So I was one of a number of consultants that was discussing, and by the way, on that particular case, I worked on the federal prosecution side. I've also worked a number of cases where the federal government was prosecuting an officer, and I was on the officer's defense team.
So it's basically the facts speak for themselves.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you really can't, I know attorneys sometimes try to spin the facts, but I deal with forensic facts. So and what does that mean, by the way? You know, I use applied science, and including medicine, whenever I can to find out whether the representations of an individual or their statement is supported by circumstances, statements, forensic facts, and evidence. That's what I do.
Right. But I also want to talk about your new book that you just came out with. I just finished this book, and for my listeners, Ron came out with a tremendous book called The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police. And this truly is this is the Bible of what's been happening recently, and is an easy read. Where can the listeners get this book, Ron?
Well, thank you for bringing that up, Randy. The easiest way to get this book is by going to Amazon.com, and we'll give you the title of the book again, or you can even type in my name, Dr. Ron Martinelli or Ron Martinelli, and it'll come up the same way. You can also, and I would really like to encourage your listeners to get on my forensic and law enforcement site and sign up for that, which is free, and you can get the book through there too, and I'll give you the URL address. It's www.dr for Dr. Ron, R-O-N, Martinelli, M-A-R, TINELLI.com. And there's lots of really great forensic articles there. There's some training tips, radio and television shows that I've done, and the book is there. So you can just click on there and get the book that way and become a follower, just like your fans, Randy, they follow you.
Right. Okay. And I'm going to put up for my listeners, I'll post that on the America Out Loud website for today's show. Now,
thank you so much.
Ron, you and I have had a number of discussions about Black Lives Matter, and our thoughts are pretty much aligned, and I think this is such a fascinating topic and one that is so timely considering everything that is happening in policing. What was it that caused you to take up this subject and to write this book, which of course takes a tremendous amount of time and research?
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, the first thing I'd like to say is I am just so blessed here with having a great staff of researchers and case analysts, people like that really make me look good. I will task them to do certain things. They'll do the research. They'll vet the research. I will re-vet the research to make sure that everything is as accurate as it possibly can be. And by the way, we put all of that accurate information and all of the references and the websites and everything to go to, because I don't want people to just take my word for it. It's a forensic, it's a factual book, and I like them just to become little investigators and begin the journey for themselves. But that being said, I don't normally write a book like this. I've written several other books. I've got some more coming out. But this particular book, I was so sick and tired of the false narratives that were being put out by this very militant political organization to put down police officers, that I felt that somebody had to say something, somebody had to put the real investigative and forensic facts out there. And then I got motivated to learn more about this group, and the more that I found about this group, the more intrigued I became, because I found it to be an extremely dangerous group for this nation.
I read the book, and it is about as well researched piece of work that I've ever seen. But still, it's a very, very easy to read book, which for people like me, I have to have my concentration level is a little low. So it's really it was an easy book for me to read, and so incredibly informative. Let's talk about just a couple things about this. Not only is it about the movement, but it highlights their input and their propaganda that they have put out when it comes to Trayvon Martin, when it comes to Ferguson and the death of Michael Brown. And so each of these really high profile events is really studied in this book. And why don't you, I was shocked at some of the things that I read. Why don't you talk about how the Black Lives Matter actually began?
Well, sure. And you mentioned the two cases that were the foundation building blocks of which this movement was predicated upon. Not too many people know about the Black Lives Matter movement, and they have those that mention the name don't know anything about the history or the context of the movement, its goals and objectives. They think it's sort of like a flash mob that gets together on their cell phones, and then all of a sudden they show up to places like Ferguson or Baltimore or New York, and they have these giant protests that put police officers down. Not too many people know that this group is actually founded by women. There are three gay women, openly gay women, that founded the Black Lives Matter movement, and they are in control of this movement and set the destiny and the goals and objectives of the movement. The next thing that people don't know is that this is in an international movement. So it isn't just here in the United States. We have tracked the founding members of the Black Lives Matter movement to Northern Ireland, to the Middle East, to Palestine, to Libya, to Cuba. And so you'd say, well, why are they going there? I mean, if this is about Black Lives Matter in the United States, what are they doing in these other countries? Well, if you notice the countries and the locations that they visit, these are all countries that foment, radical, militant, violent, and revolutionary movements, and they get into a lot of problems, as we know. Hezbollah, the Cuban Revolutionary Movement in Northern Ireland with the Irish Republican Army, places such as this. And so these people from the BLM go there to cross-train with other revolutionaries. A lot of people don't know that the movement is extremely well-funded. George Soros, who people might have heard about, is a big funder of this organization. Beyonce and Jay-Z Carter are big supporters and benefactors to this movement. So it's a pretty extreme movement.
Well, let's get down to the basic philosophies and the ideology of the three women that started Black Lives Matter. Let's go into that for just a moment.
Well, sure. The movement was started by Opal Tamati, Patrice Kaloors, and Alicia Garza, actually started by Alicia Garza. And they started this movement after the jury acquitted George Zimmerman for the self-defense justifiable homicide of Trayvon Martin. And then that started in 2013. And then in 2014, we had the Michael Brown and Officer Darren Wilson case, where Darren Wilson justifiably shot Michael Brown, who had violently assaulted him, tried to take his gun away from him, and then ran away. And then the officer chased after him, gave him numerous commands to stop. All of a sudden, Michael Brown turns around and basically bum-rushed Officer Wilson, and Officer Wilson was forced to shoot and kill him. And we're talking about a man, Michael Brown, who was 6'3", weighed about 290 pounds, almost 300 pound guy. A huge guy. Can you imagine somebody like this? You fighting with somebody like this, who's already fought with you, punched you, tried to take your gun away, tried to kill you, and you're not going to stop a guy like that with pepper spray or a taser.
Right.
I talked about those cases. So the women started this organization, it was, Opal Tamati, who is the social media expert. So she got Black Lives Matter up and running on Facebook and Instagram and all the different social media things. They started actively recruiting people. They got significant funding from George Soros, who is avowed leftist, who's actually a felon in a couple of other countries. For currency manipulation in Bulgaria and in France. And he is very much anti-United States, anti-democratic government. What people don't know is all of the rhetoric that the founders of the movement and their surrogates use, and he is Marxist. And so it is absolutely not democratic. They favor Marxist governments. That's why they go to, Cuba, which is a communist Marxist revolutionary government. They go to Northern Ireland, which is both, revolutionary and run by people that are Marxists. And then they go over to Hamas, which is not a Marxist government, but it is a terrorist organization. So they, all of the rhetoric that they use is very much Marxist. If you pay attention to the people that the founders of the movement resonate with and who they admire, every single one of those people is a Marxist revolutionary. Not only that, but they are convicted cop killers. So when, you know, when they get out in these protest marches and they yell, you know, what do we want now? Dead cops. What do we want them now? And you know, put them in a pan and fry them like bacon. I mean, that's a truthful sentiment that these people have. They're very dangerous.
So when you saw that President Obama invited Black Lives Matter into the White House to actually meet with them and talk about the issues that they're concerned about, how did that affect you?
Well, you know, it's not a surprise to me that President Obama would gravitate towards a group like this. Number one, President Obama and even the past, you know, Attorney General Eric Holder, they see things only as black and white issues. The entire prism of how they look at law enforcement and how we interact with the public is only through the black prism. And it's a very dark place to be. And so, I mean, and literally, you know, you're talking about a man that before he was president of the United States and he was a community activist, he was also a professor and taught constitutional law, you know. And I'm saying, how can a guy that is taught constitutional law be zero for five of the different events that he has criticized law enforcement over or has resonated or had supported, you know, not only Michael Brown's family, but Trayvon Martin's family without, you know, supporting, you know, in Michael Brown, Darren Wilson case, which was a law enforcement shooting, not doing anything to support that poor officer. And in the George Zimmerman case, you know, not at least supporting the verdict by that jury there. And listen, George Zimmerman, like I say in the book, George Zimmerman's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, okay?
Right.
He made decisions that probably you and I, Randy, or your listeners would not have made, but that didn't mean that they were illegal, and that didn't mean that he wasn't violently assaulted and waited to the very last minute where he could have easily been killed before he shot Trayvon Martin. You know, I mean, so when you get a president of the United States that is, you know, inviting people to the White House who value cop killers from the 60s and 70s, and, you know, his friend was Bill Ayers from the Weather Underground, and by the way, the Black Lives Matter people admire the people from the 60s that were in the Weather Underground. I mean, it isn't really a big, it shouldn't be, it's not a surprise to me, and I doubt if it's a surprise to your listeners.
Yeah, it probably is not a surprise, but still a great disappointment.
It is a great disappointment.
So, you know, what's interesting to me is from your expert point of view as a forensic criminologist, you had the opportunity to follow these two high-profile death cases involving law enforcement, and that must have been very interesting for you to observe that evidence and be able to create your own private conclusion as to the righteousness of those deaths.
Well, right, and it is, because this type of case is exactly what we get involved in, you know, as forensic experts, and me in particular with police practices and use of force, you know, and I also do self-defense. So starting out with the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin thing, that is a civilian, you know, self-defense case. Now, it's interesting that the Black Lives Matter people tried to somehow infer or join that with police involved cases.
That is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's completely separate.
But somehow they managed to spin it effectively.
Well, that's just part of the false narrative. Because here's what they depend on, and it's funny because it's just like, you know, this Obama administration or, you know, this Hillary Clinton thing. They depend upon people not being informed, okay? And that's what you're dealing with. People that just, you know, if they say it, it's true, and they just keep repeating it and repeating it, because, you know, it's been said that the more you repeat something, the more people will believe that it's true.
Right.
And so this book is sort of that anti philosophy, where what we try to do here is forensically and truthfully educate people. And what you'll see is I really don't put too many of my opinions in this book. What I want the reader to do is read the research, confirm the research we've done, and make up their own minds. I try very hard to give a lot of credit to readers to not be stupid, to make up their own minds.
Right, I understand that, and you lead the pathway here in the way that you have in the way you've portrayed this this entire subject matter. So, you know, I really want to thank you for creating this book. I think that it was just recently you just recently put it out. So,
right. Yeah, we just put it out about 4 weeks ago, and I am not kidding you, it is flying off the shelf. I'm so happy to have done 2 years, put 2 years of my life into this thing, and see how the book has been resonating with not only the law enforcement and forensic community, but just regular people. So we're super happy about that.
Now, are you going to make yourself available to speak on this topic?
Absolutely. You know, the idea that we developed when I first brought this book out, I was asked to come up to Chicago where the International Law Enforcement Educators and Trainers Conference is. It's the largest group of law enforcement trainers in the world. There's over 5,000 members. They asked us, they asked me to come up and talk about this book, and it just received such an amazing response that what I've decided to do is take this book out around the country and, you know, give talks to not only law enforcement, but to the media as well, to educate them about this very violent and militant organization. We're going to have to really watch ourselves here, because they have some goals and objectives that are absolutely anti-law enforcement, but even more importantly, anti-democratic government.
And that's the story of Black Lives Matter, and it's a vital, vital, factual-based story that really needs to get out, and the American public needs to fully understand. Once again, Ron, thanks so much for being on the radio today, and for appearing on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Great. And thank you, Randy. And one more time, for listeners that might have come into this thing a little bit late, they can find that book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, on Amazon.com.
And we will have a link on our website at AmericaOutloud.com. Thanks again, Ron, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Randy. Bye-bye.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
If you're a regular listener to this program, you probably know that one of the segments that I do is called Police Story. I take stories that are written by either active duty or retired former police officers, that some of whom are true authors in their own right, some of whom have never written anything before, but it gives a perspective that's different. And this week's story is written by a former police officer. He was with the Baltimore City Police Department. He was also a former chief of police in West Virginia. But he's also a writer. He wrote a book called Still Seeking Justice, One Officer's Story. And you can learn more about him. His name is Joel Gordon. And you can check him out at stillseekingjustice.com. So this story is called Unarmed. By my third night working Baltimore's Western Police District 725 post by myself on the 4 to 12 shift, I found myself in foot pursuit of a suspect in an assault who was armed with a gun. Heading north from the 2000 block of Edmondson, I pursued the suspect for over three long blocks in trash-laden and rat-infested alleys. I was so intent on catching this bad guy that I really forgot anything else. All of my energy was spent on the chase. Fortunately, the police helicopter, Foxtrot, had my back and was overhead calling out my location by radio while spotlighting the chase. I was really lucky because the suspect threw his gun while running from me, later safely recovered, and didn't choose to shoot at me, probably only due to the helicopter being a witness. I caught up to the suspect and got him up against the side of the brick building to make the arrest, searching and cuffing him. My first big arrest. I was young and naive, and really wasn't wise enough to be afraid yet. Somehow, I didn't realize how real this was. I had the attitude, what are they going to do, eat me? Unfortunately, it wouldn't be long before I would learn to realize just how real this all was. I graduated the police academy on April of 1981. On Monday, July 20th, barely 3 months out of the academy, Ron Tracy, one of the officers who reached out to me on my first day, was shot and killed toward the end of our shift while on duty. I was the sixth car on the scene. Officer Ronald Tracy was shot and killed with his own weapon after being attacked at the intersection of Monroe and Baker. It was the end of a busy 4 to 12 shift. I was waiting to be called in for shift change about three blocks south of the Western District Police Station. Officers were to stay on their posts until called in, but it was commonplace to sneak in close to the station to expedite the end of the shift. Ron Chase Tracy had a different approach this night and volunteered to handle a late minor accident so as to be able to get off on time. A little before midnight, still waiting for the next shift to conclude their roll call and be called in, a static crackling noise emanated from the radio's speaker microphone that I was wearing. I don't know why, but I immediately placed my patrol car into drive, feeling that something was wrong. But where to go? Almost immediately, citizens began calling in an officer down at Monroe and Baker. I was immediately en route with only a few blocks to go. As the sixth car in the scene, I saw a uniformed officer down in the road, lying in a half-fetal position in the gutter of Monroe Street. I saw his uniform, his empty holster, and witnessed what was clearly brain fluid and brain matter flowing south from the officer's head down the gutter. This was a minor traffic accident scene. It turned out that it was Officer Tracy that had been disarmed from behind by a bystander of the accident. He'd been shot once in the abdomen and once in the head. Other officers rushed him by patrol car to the hospital, but to no avail. I took my lead from veteran field training officer Dwight Thomas, who was also on the scene by then. Numerous calls began to come in with what turned out to be accurate information as to the suspect's direction of travel. Even information on the suspect's identity and address of his mother's house was accurate. This is an area where nobody ever saw anything. When we were informed of the suspect's mother's address, Dwight, with a shotgun, and several other officers and I turned up at the address, but he was not found. Dwight told me I should call my people to let them know I was all right. I was still living at home with my parents then. I called and woke them up to let them know I was okay. Two shifts of officers stayed on the street in our attempt to locate the perpetrator for several hours. It was as if the rest of the world was at a standstill. Tensions were high, and I have no doubt that if we had found the suspect in the Western District that night, he might not have survived that confrontation. The suspect was located on Tuesday, about 14 hours later, in the Northeastern Police District, and was taken into custody, unharmed. I learned that night that this was for real. Life and death was hanging in the balance. When one works in an inner-city, high-crime area, you learn not to understand, but to accept that there is a criminal element that has no regard for human life, yours or their own. The loss of a fellow officer in this fashion is something that you carry with you forever. I relive this incident each time I hear an officer being accused of shooting a, quote, unarmed, unquote, suspect. We must always remember the risk officers face of being disarmed and harmed by their own weapons and realize that in these circumstances, officers must do whatever is necessary to stop the threat. Officer Ronald Tracy's murderer was convicted and sentenced to 45 years in prison, but it was paroled in January of 2014. Rest in peace, Ron Tracy. And that is your police story for this episode of Police Radio. It is the voice of American law enforcement, and I am your host, Randy Sutton. If you have a police story that you want to submit, contact me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Thank you.